Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last night, before a full house at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City, presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin spoke on how the qualities of 4 past presidents equipped them to lead the country during turbulent times. I spoke with her on stage and included some audience questions. We'll listen to highlights from that from last night later in the hour. But during this first half hour, we'll listen back to parts of previous conversations I've had with Doris Kearns Goodwin, one from 2013 and one from 2015. In 2013, we spoke about her then new book, The Bully Pulpit: Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. I started that conversation by having her explain the nature of the conflict between Roosevelt and Taft.
Well, the thing that so interested me as I explored what to do about Theodore Roosevelt, who I wanted to write about, was the realization that his friendship with Taft was much longer and richer than I had known. And he had actually handpicked Taft as his successor, believing that Taft was the best man to carry out his legacy after his own presidency was done. So when he finally decided that he thought Taft had not been following his legacy and decided to run against him, it wasn't simply a political split. It was a deep rift in a friendship that had mattered deeply to both men. So on a human level, you know, not just the drama and the colorful nature of that 1912 election, but what it meant to these two men who had been so close for so long is what I wanted to study in this story.
Mm-hmm. And what were the issues that separated? You said Theodore Roosevelt didn't think Taft followed his vision. What was the difference in issues?
Well, you know, the really interesting thing is the country was moving even further toward progressive reform. Excuse me. And as a result, Taft was with Teddy, but then I think began to question some of the changes that were coming about. I mean, in particular, Theodore Roosevelt called in 1912. He was so upset with courts who were strangling progressive reform that he called for the idea that people themselves could overturn a court decision, you know, by a popular vote. And Taft, who had been a judge and loved the judiciary more than life, really separated with him on that issue. But bizarrely, the thing that really drew them apart was that Theodore Roosevelt had never taken on the tariff issue because he knew it would split the Republican Party in two between the farmers in the West and the manufacturers in the East. Taft courageously took it on, but then didn't deal well enough with the people in Congress who really didn't want to do it, and he just made people mad by trying to do something good. So it's a very complicated situation on the substantive level, but on the human level, it's straightforward, and I found it really dramatic.
Mm-hmm. The Golden Age of Journalism is included in your title. Describe the hallmarks of journalism in that day. Why was it seen as golden in the era of Taft and Roosevelt?
Well, what mattered so much in this period of time was the emergence of a group of investigative reporters who are considered now, with a badge of honor, muckrakers. So they come along. It's not like all journalism was golden, and there certainly were yellow journals at the same time, but this particular group, who are so honored in the history of journalism, Ida Tarbell, Ray Baker, William Allen White, and Lincoln Steffens, they're all at one magazine called McClure's. And what matters is they create these long pieces that show the abuses of the railroad, that show what's happening with these big monopolies, the difficulties with food and drug legislation, and it creates the pressure from the public to force the Congress to do something about the problems of the industrial age. And they really form a partnership in some ways with Theodore Roosevelt. So for many of them who lived later on in their lives, they looked back on this time when they were changing the country, or so they believed, as a golden age.
Let's go back to the politics of 1912. You talked about the close friendship at one time between Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, and then their rivalry as well. Let's bring that into the future, too, because, of course, the GOP has got a rift in it today. Are there any similarities that you can see?
Well, you know, it's so interesting when you start these books. You know, when I started it 7 years ago, I certainly wasn't thinking particularly about how the GOP is mobilizing today with this faction that's very passionate, the Tea Party faction, and a more moderate or establishment kind of faction. And at that time, what you had was a progressive faction that, you know, it was the other way around in a certain sense. The left had the passion and had that unwillingness to sometimes to compromise. And the establishment part of the party was unwilling to move forward. And they fought each other and, of course, split apart in 1912 and both lose as a result. So I think the cautionary lesson is that when a party divides, if they can't come together in a certain kind of compromise, then as it happened in 1912, the Democrats won that presidential election and won the House and won the Senate. And the Republicans had been in control for many decades, except for Cleveland's presidency, until that time.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the adversaries of the Republicans, the Democrats, trying to drive that wedge as deeply as possible, aren't we?
I suppose so. The scam thing is, this is all true for politics and who wins, but for the country itself, we need these parties to get together within themselves mm-hmm. and between themselves. The political culture in Washington, I think, is more difficult than I've seen it in my entire lifetime. I mean, think back to the 1960s with LBJ. As difficult a presidency as he had in the war in Vietnam, he was able to get compromise in that Congress. He was able to get people to do extraordinary things, three great civil rights laws, Medicare, AIDS, education. And it wasn't only his leadership, which was a big part of it. I mean, he would call those senators every morning, every night. He'd call them at 2 in the morning. I hope I didn't wake you up. And the guy says, no, I was just looking at the ceiling, hoping my president would call. But he had a political culture where they formed friendships across party lines because the congressmen and senators didn't race home on the weekends to raise money for their next escalating campaign costs. They stayed in Washington. Their wives formed friendships across party lines. And they could then call on each other when they needed to. So he could call on Everett Dirksen, the minority leader of the Republicans, when he had to break the filibuster on civil rights, in a way that now those friendships are so frayed, if they exist at all, that we've got much more of a tribal situation down there.
Doris, you're coming to Iowa to talk about leadership lessons from Abraham Lincoln. President Obama drew comparisons with Lincoln in forming his cabinet, this team of rivals. For instance, Hillary Clinton, a main case in point. How is that seen as a good thing, to have rivals in your team?
I think the most important thing is that if you bring people in who can question your assumptions, who can argue with you, it means that you have to think better about the issues. And in Lincoln's case, obviously having those different factions of his own party, ranging from conservative to moderate to radical, as he made decisions about emancipation, as he made decisions about how to conduct the war, he had to argue within his inner circle first. And I think it strengthens your thinking. Lincoln said when he appointed all these rivals, the country is in peril. These are the strongest and most able men in the country. I need them by my side.
We still have the majority of President Obama's second term ahead of us. As a historian, what can you say about how this president will go down in history, what he will be remembered for?
I think no question, and given, you know, the race relations problem this country has had ever since the earliest days, with slavery being the curse on us, the fact that the first African-American president was chosen will go down in history as a mark of social justice, I think. However, the health care situation, if it gets straightened out and the bill does become one that gives access to more people and doesn't hurt the economic situation, if it all works itself out, the fact that he was the first president after 100 years of other people trying to get that health care through, I think will be remembered. Depending on how the economy goes and people looking at the depth of the recession in the beginning of his term, if we come out of it and are strengthened by the end, he will be given credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulties, I think, of how he dealt with the country and used the bully pulpit, interestingly, will be something that people will be surprised at when they look at it, given what a great speaker he was when he first came into this office.
That he's such a great speaker and yet relatively ineffective? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you would have expected that that would have been his greatest strength in a certain sense. And then the question is the bully pulpit itself today less powerful than it used to be? when a president gave a speech, you know, as Reagan did or as JFK did, they'd be on those television networks. Everybody would be watching. When FDR gave his radio addresses, 80% of the adult radio audience would be listening. Now you get pundits on there even before the person is finished. Somebody yells in a congressional session, you lie, and that becomes the story. Our attention is fragmented today. We've got fragmented television, so not everybody's listening, and it's not part of the national dialogue. Something comes up, and then the subject changes so quickly, whether it's from gun control to immigration, back to Syria. You have a feeling that it may be that it's harder today to use that bully pulpit, but it's still an essential tool, I think, for a president to be an effective leader.
Mm-hmm. And we hear references about the struggles today getting that health care law passed, comparisons to an era you're very familiar with, working with President Johnson and passing some of the social legislation at that time. How are they different? Will we, in 20 years, as we many of us have when we look back at the 60s, forgotten the struggle that the Johnson administration had and remember what those efforts yielded?
That's a really good point. I think you're right. When we're in the middle of one of these things and it's a messy process to get a bill through, and it's maybe not the exact bill that people wanted because compromise is necessary, you sometimes don't credit it in the same way as you do looking back now 50 years on what it was that LBJ was able to accomplish. Still, he had some sort of magical ability, I think, to understand, to make the Congress feel part. Now, he had a big majority. That helps a lot. Plus, he had, you know, the aura of people wanting to do something to make good for JFK's assassination, particularly on civil rights. And he had a civil rights movement that was pressuring people from the bottom up, and a union movement that was pressuring people to do things about poverty and do things about jobs. So it was a more fruitful combination of things that doesn't exist today. But I think everybody's just hoping that something will break the logjam that will allow these characters down there to feel like they are making progress on the problems we still face.
That was presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin from a conversation I had in 2013 with her. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I spoke with Doris Kearns Goodwin again in 2015. At a time when populism was on the rise in this country. So I started that conversation by asking her to define what we meant by a populist.
Well, I think what it's meant in history at times is that there is a candidate who can somehow arouse the spirit of the larger public. And often that spirit is one that feels they're not being fairly treated by the elites who are in power. And populism really rose in the 1880s, 1890s, when the farmers in the West felt that the people in the East who were making more money and dealing with silver and gold in certain ways were not watching out over the little person's interests. And interestingly, at that time, the populists came forth with a series of social programs that really did get taken up by the progressives and became part of Theodore Roosevelt's presidency, even though those original populists did not win the elections by themselves.
It's interesting that former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich was on this program not too long ago, and he compared our current age to that, the so-called Gilded Age, in terms of the great economic or growing economic inequality. Teddy Roosevelt came at the end of this. So this was many decades that led up to Teddy Roosevelt, his trust busting, his breaking up of the huge monopolies.
Absolutely. In fact, what was happening is the anger and the frustration that was building in the country in the 1880s and 1890s and early 20th century about the income gap, the Industrial Revolution was creating that same gap that the Technological Revolution has expanded. There was a sense of dizzying inventions that were being made, that the pace of life was speeding up, people were moving from the farm to the city. So it was a disorienting age, much like our own. And so that was really the spur for the populist movement. And you get William Jennings Bryan running as, you know, first as a populist and then as a Democrat in 1896. And then when Teddy Roosevelt gets in, what he's able to do is to take that spirit of populism, but to make it less scary to the country as a whole. so that even though he takes on the big industries and he breaks them up and he gets exploited workers help and he deals with some of the problems of the industrial order, he doesn't have that same fear that had been put into the country by some of the earlier orders of populism.
Mm-hmm. So what did he have at that point that tipped the balance that allowed him to overcome the vested interests of these huge monopolies of the time?
What he did was to mobilize the public sentiment that the populists had begun to create and say to his Republican colleagues in the Senate and the House, unless you are willing to start making rational actions that deal with some of the problems of the industrial order, then socialism is on the rise. So he was for the square deal. He was right in the middle of both of these things. He wasn't a conservative like his Republicans were. He wasn't a radical socialist. He was somebody who said, I'm for the worker and the capitalist. I'm for the rich and the poor as long as they deal fairly with one another. So he hit exactly the right target that allowed him to mobilize public sentiment to push an unwilling Congress to have to take actions, maybe not as further actions as the socialists, if they'd been in power, would have taken, but certainly a far greater number than the conservatives who were in power wanted to take.
Mm-hmm. And in this day and age, we have someone calling himself a democratic socialist who, by his own account, is surprised at the popularity, the enthusiasm that he is garnering across the country. And Bernie Sanders is a populist in this vein.
Yes, he is. And I think, I've heard him make the argument, and I think it's the strongest one he has, as to what it is that he can bring to the table. And that is that so far he has been able to mobilize a large group of people coming out to see him who feel like they're part of a revolution. They feel they're part of a movement rather than simply just voting for a candidate. And that if he can keep doing that, that he creates that public sentiment that can bring the change and force action in Congress. I mean, I think the problem when you look at it historically is that that happened, too, when Obama was elected. There was a feeling that he had created a citizen army and it would keep going and bring about change. And he certainly did bring about a lot of change in those early years of his presidency. But then Washington got frozen and public sentiment was not able to push in at it anymore. So the question is, how long lasting does that citizen energy go after the election is done? Can it really keep pushing in? What you had in the early part of the Teddy Roosevelt administration was an investigative press that really created the climate that allowed the change to take place because they kept hammering people with really good articles on what was going on in the meatpacking plants, what was going on in the railroads, what was going on in Standard Oil. And people got excited about it, and then they kept pressuring their congressmen, and action took place. Politics in those days was more a part of people's everyday lives. And as I say, when these investigative reporters would write their 40,000, 30,000-word, 20,000-word articles, they were being lapped up by people all over the country and talked about. The difference today is I think we're so frenetic and there's so much division of attention and people are trying to get along with two careers and they're watching politics as a spectator sport more than they were participating in it in that earlier era. So whether that connection between the excitement and the anger and the frustration and the populism can really mobilize government these days, I think it's harder than it would have been back then.
Mm-hmm. So if we talk about populism, the rise of populism then and now, when we look at that historical precedent, how does populism typically resolve itself in this country? When and why does it ebb after it has flowed?
Well, in the case of the populism at the turn of the 20th century, it really did flow right into the progressive wing of the Republican Party and then the Democratic Party. So when the populists were calling for minimum wages or maximum hours or treating women better in the factories, or income tax or direct election of senators, those things happened. So William Allen White, a reporter, said that what progressivism was populism dressed up in middle-class dress or something. So in that sense, you do see it flowing in a way and influencing public policy. Sometimes populism also comes, as it did in the anti-immigration time, and I think this connects to Trump in a way. There was a spirit also in the 19th century of nativism that was developing, because we had a lot of immigration coming in from Eastern Europe, from Italy, new groups of immigrants, and that always arouses this feeling of we have to be worried about what's happening to America, and that was pretty strong then too. And it did eventually result in some limitations on immigration. And I think that wave, if we look at that historically, almost every wave of immigration we've had has resulted in positive impacts on America. I mean, that we've become this country of other countries. But when you're in the middle of one of those new waves, there is that sense of anxiety, which I think can be part of the anger and the excitement that's fueling, you know, the original reason why Trump got that amazing support right from the start was his anti-immigration stand.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a couple more minutes about Donald Trump compared to Bernie Sanders. Both put in the populist category, though, because their followers both believe there are great wrongs being committed.
That is correct. And that does seem to be a trend of what it means when people feel that the governing structure in Washington, they feel removed from it, that somehow it isn't answering their needs or doing what they want. So in that case, you know, an outsider, you know, like Trump, who can say, you know, I'm going to change these things and I'm not beholden to those special interests. I think one of the big differences between now and the turn of the 20th century, too, is just the role that money plays has escalated so enormously in public life that that it becomes a thing in itself. And that's where Trump's strength comes from, saying, I'm not taking money from anybody else. I'm not responsive to those very special interests that are hurting you. And Sanders, because his ideology is removed from the ordinary place, seems more, even though he's not an outsider, he's been in politics for a long time, he can carry that same momentum, I think, in a certain sense.
That was part of a conversation I had in 2015 with renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin. After a short break, we'll zoom into the present with our presidential historian this hour, Doris Kearns Goodwin. We'll listen to highlights of my conversation with her recorded last night at Hampshire Auditorium in Iowa City. It was a sold-out crowd, 1,800 people in the audience. Her latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, examines how the qualities of four past presidents, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, and Johnson, equipped them to lead the country. That's coming up. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Last night, world-renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin spoke before an audience of about 1,800 people. It was a full house at Hampshire Auditorium in Iowa City. Kearns Goodwin has spent more than 5 decades studying American presidents, and in fact, she worked as an assistant to President Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. In 2018, she came out with her 7th book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, and in it, she examined the leadership qualities of Presidents Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, and how their most notable qualities, leadership qualities, equipped them to lead the country during turbulent times. Now, we were not allowed to broadcast her prepared remarks to the audience last night. However, after those remarks, we can bring you some highlights of the Q&A. That's when I joined her on stage to ask her some questions of my own, along with questions from the audience. I should note here that I spoke with her the night before the planned release of the much-anticipated and redacted Mueller report. So now, let's listen to highlights of a Q&A with Doris Kearns Goodwin last night at Hancher Auditorium.
I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio. How many IPR, NPR fans do we have out there tonight? Applaud if you plan to caucus for a candidate in February.
Wow.
So February 3rd is our date of the next year, and Doris, I'm sure you're well aware that our audience is close to 100% caucus-goers here. So I want to start off by pulling you into the present, but using your extensive study of leadership qualities of these four presidents in your latest book. What can you tell us about the leadership qualities that Iowans should be looking for during this caucus season?
Well, I think that really is the most important question to look at. You know, I was talking before to some people about Tim Russert, and before he died, he and I talked about the fact that the way journalists cover campaigns, especially then and it's simply true now, is who sings who in a debate, who raises the most money, you know, who's made a mark at that moment. When they've all come from somewhere, if you look at all those 18 and maybe it'll be 21 candidates on the Democratic side, or if we had known that perhaps more about candidate Trump, we should have looked at what kind of leadership he had exhibited before. We should look at these characters and figure out what kind of teams have they built. Do they have emotional intelligence? When things go wrong, do they accept responsibility? Do they have integrity? Have they been able to show empathy and humility? And it shouldn't just be a magazine article. It's what we should really be talking about with each one of these. And you know, I had a mentor at Harvard named Richard Neustadt. And he said the best thing to know about a president is what they did right before they got there and what mm-hmm. kind of a life they had. They're not going to change fundamentally. So I think when you look at these candidates and you get a chance to talk to them, you should be talking about their teams, talking about, you know, what difficult times they'd gotten through and how they had resilience to do that. And hopefully the more we do that, I mean, raising money is not the symbol, although it's more now than before because you have to raise it among smaller groups of people. So it means there's an enthusiasm for you. But in the old days when you just had big donors, it was crazy that should be a mark of who was number one in the polls. So that's what I would encourage, just to look at those leadership traits and try and figure out what these candidates have done before, wherever they were before they got to this point, and how well they were able to succeed.
I wonder, Doris, if you can say you've looked at the turbulent times of these presidents, several presidents. Do any of the times that you study in history remind you of what we're currently experiencing, have a bearing on it, have any lesson for us that we can take from history?
I do think so. I do think, and I just hinted at it a little bit, that the turn of the 20th century is the best echo for now. There was a big populist movement that developed because people felt the system wasn't responding to them because of that industrial age. There was a feeling that there were so many new inventions, the automobile and the telegraph and the telephone, that the old way of life was going backwards mm-hmm. and that we didn't know where we were going. There was a sense of the pace of life moving too fast. People in the rural areas felt cut off from people in the cities. And there was a sense that, as I said, that the gap had developed between the rich and the poor. And in that kind of an environment, the populist movement was arguing against immigration. There was a big anti-immigration mood at that time, against Wall Street, against the establishment. And it was a pretty volatile group of populists that were out there. It later got channeled into a progressive movement, which was more of a middle-class movement on both sides. But there was a real fear at that time that democracy was at risk. And I think that reminds me of now and what globalization has done, not just even in America. You're seeing these populist movements all over the world right now. And I think the question is, have the countries not responded to that desire for mobility and a lot of people feeling they've been left out from the system? Lincoln said the most important thing is somehow to be able to rise to the level of your talent and your discipline. And that's where education has to become still more important than it is. If I had one thing to do, I would give teachers a higher salary. We've got to get the best people going into teaching. It's a really important mobility. And to the extent that the system has been prosperous, but not everybody has shared in that prosperity, it leads to that populist movement, exactly what was felt at the turn of the 20th century. this makes me think of something different, which is that most change that has occurred in the country has come from the citizens. It's not usually from the leaders. I mean, Lincoln was called a liberator. He said, don't call me that. It was the anti-slavery people that did it all. And what changed at the turn of the 20th century, and that's why the recent midterms and all that burst of enthusiasm is so important to me, what changed everything at the turn of the 20th, it wasn't just Teddy Roosevelt, it was that a group of social activists had risen in the society, the settlement house movement in the cities, the social gospel in the religions, and they created the progressive movement that was the foundation underneath him. And of course, without the civil rights movement, Lincoln, LBJ couldn't have done what he did. He had the women's movement, the environmental movement. We need a movement now for changing our political structure. It definitely needs change. We need to have nonpartisan commissions to draw congressional boundaries. We have to get the poison of money out of the system. We've got to figure out what to do about the Electoral College. There's a lot, and these things can be changed. I mean, FDR said problems created by man can be solved by man. So it's up to us. It's up, and you guys have a huge role in it right now.
We do. We do indeed. Before we get to our first question from the audience, I wanted to see if you'd to share an anecdote from a recent Politico article, if I could just read a few lines of it. I'm quoting the article. During a guided tour of Mount Vernon last April with French President Emmanuel Macron, you've read the article, I can see on your
love
face.
Love it. Keep going.
Trump learned that Washington was one of the major real estate speculators of his era, so he couldn't understand why America's first president didn't name his historic Virginia compound or any other property he acquired after himself. You've got to put your name on stuff or no one remembers you. The VIP's tour guide told the president that Washington did, after all, succeed in getting the nation's capital named after him. Good point, Trump said with a laugh. Now, Donald Trump is open about the fact, Doris, that he doesn't read much history. Trump said in 2016, perhaps he said other times, but in 2016 at the very least, he said he has never read a presidential biography and had no plans to do so. Each of the men you profile in your latest book were the heroes for the ones who came after them. How important was that for these past presidents to look to their predecessors for lessons?
It's true, just exactly as it said. It's almost like a family tree of the people I studied. For LBJ, FDR was his huge hero, and he had known him when he was young, and he looked at what he had done. He had read about the New Deal. He understood what had happened. Obviously, he was there during World War II. And then FDR's hero was Teddy Roosevelt, and he wanted to have the same trajectory as Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt's hero was Lincoln, and during the summer where he had this terrible coal strike, one of the hardest crises that he faced in his presidency, he read all the volumes of Nicolay and Hay that summer, and he would say out loud, Lincoln did this at this point. He had this problem between extremes on either side. He did it. I can do it. And then Lincoln's hero, of course, was George Washington, and not because George Washington didn't name Mount Vernon after himself. One of the nice things that happened when President Obama was in the White House, he asked me to organize for him a group of historians who would come to dinner every now and then, and we would come as our presidents, whether it was Jackson or Jefferson or Reagan or Lincoln, and we would give him advice. We wouldn't dress up as our guys, but we would come and tell him what our guys might tell him about whatever problem he was facing. And they were wonderful evenings for us, but I'd like to think they were for President Obama too, because he could learn from these people. So I just keep, if I had a dream, it would be that, you know, Lincoln and the Roosevelts and LBJ would come back to life for at least a day and go to the White House and talk to President Trump. That would be the
right.
Best.
I have a feeling you can see one of the cards with an audience question here, and the question reads, if your four guys were alive today, what advice would they give to Donald Trump?
Well, you know, I think the main advice they would give is that, I mean, the most important thing when you become president is to be able to look to the country as a whole and be the president of the people and not simply the people who elected you. You have to be able to have him, and I think maybe connected to that, once you get into that incredible office, the ambition for yourself has to be transformed into an ambition for the greater good. If you really want to be remembered by history, it's not by putting your name on a building. It's not by changing Mount Vernon to George Washington. All of those guys that I know, at some point, they decided that they wanted to be remembered. That's a good thing, to want to be remembered by history for having expanded social justice or economic opportunity and made the country feel a better place when you left. And that's the goal that you want any president to have. And if they could just tell him, if you really want to be remembered by history, you have to move toward expanding your base. You have to be able to convince people that you're doing something for the good of the country and not for your name alone. Whether they could do that or not, that would be a miracle, but it would be a great thing.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, among our audience of about 1,800 here at Hampshire Auditorium, someone with the news of tomorrow on their mind, asking, how significant do you think the Mueller report will be to historians a generation or two from now?
Oh, it's a really great question. I mean, I think, you know, it takes a long time to really understand what goes on within an administration. You wait for memoirs, you wait for diaries in the old days, for letters. And this report and all the ramifications of it, and eventually historians will see the whole report, my guess is, even if we may not see it tomorrow or next week or a few months from now. And because it consumes so much of the presidency, because it's going to tell not only about Russia and the collusion thing, that's the brilliance of what Trump has done, is to make it seem like that's all it was about. But I think it's going to lay out a little bit about his presidency and how the White House staff was organized and what he was doing if he were to obstruct things. It's going to be critical, I think, for historians in future years. It may be the most important thing that's defined the first 2.5 years, and it probably may have some bearing on the presidency. So I just wish I were able to read it now. That would be great. Like, some people have read it all, and you keep knowing it's in their heads already, and I don't know that we're really going to get it for a period of time. It's already been shaped brilliantly. I mean, you must say that one of the things Lincoln said was that with public sentiment, everything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. And so far, President Trump has been very successful in shaping public sentiment already about this Mueller report, and Barr has given in to that as well. So it's a complete exoneration, you know, no collusion, no obstruction. And then tomorrow, I gather, they're having a press conference at 8:30, mm-hmm. Before anyone's had a chance maybe to read the report, and they're going to be able to say what it is before it is. And people's attention span is small, and there's a desire to move on to other things right now. So I don't know that it will have the impact we thought it would 6 months ago as it's going to have now because of all that.
An audience member has this question for you. The leaders you have studied had great ambition. Can you speak to the relationship of ambition and sacrifice? Are ambitious leaders conscious of personal sacrifice, or do we assign it to them in hindsight? What a
question.
Wow,
that's a really good question.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, as I think I tried to say, I think the word ambition sometimes is a negative word, and it's not at all. Without that drive for success, without the energy to do something, there's no way of achieving anything. So I think ambition is a good thing. And the interesting thing is, when the founding fathers talked about ambition, their ambition was open, but they wanted to make, they were conscious, I think, if you read their letters sometimes, that they were doing something extraordinary by creating a new country. Whether you're conscious that you're sacrificing, I think LBJ was conscious that he knew that when he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, that he was probably losing the South for the Democratic Party for a generation, which he did, and he knew that would rebound back on him. But then at a certain point, if you're also thinking, it's also a selfish but a good thing to want to be remembered by history, then maybe you're willing to say, I can sacrifice it now. For example, Lincoln, in the August of 1864, this is the best example, I think, in some ways. The war was still going on. Hundreds of thousands had died. Despite the victory at Gettysburg the year before, the Grant was stuck. And the people in the North, after the Emancipation Proclamation, and a lot of the legislatures were passing resolutions against it, feeling that even in the North, that he had extended the war because of insisting on emancipation instead of just reunion. So the top Republicans came to talk to him to say, you're never going to win this election in November of 64 unless you're willing to convene peace talks just on the basis of union, putting emancipation aside. And he said, I would be damned in time and eternity if I returned the black warriors to slavery. So they left disconsolate, and he thought he might lose the election. And he wanted to win it so badly. He said, you want to be returned by your fellow citizens who then, it's a judgment on your last 4 years. But he was willing, and he knew it, to sacrifice that. Then, of course, Sherman takes Atlanta. The whole mood of the North changed, and he won the election with union and emancipation intact. But I think he was aware when he did that at that moment. But maybe sometimes you're not, and then it just is what we ascribe to them later.
What are you working on now?
Well, what I'm doing now is, my husband of 42 years died last spring, and he was working on a book, and I'd love to finish it if I can. With his best friend, best man at our wedding, and my best friend, we're going to try and do it. It's pretty hard emotionally, but I know that if we could do it, it would be something. And what the book was really an argument for public service, so much of what we've been talking about tonight. So he went to Harvard Law School, graduated first in his class, was editor of the Law Review, clerked for Justice Frankfurter, could have had a job, speaking of lawyers, as we did earlier, in any law firm in the country. But instead, he decided he wanted to try and go into public service. So he became first a member of the Congressional Committee, and he was the one who discovered that the rigged television quiz shows were rigged, $21,000 and $64,000 question. In fact, the movie Robert Redford was made about my husband, played by Rob Morrow. And then he just wasn't ready to practice law right then. He then became the second speechwriter with JFK, was on the campaign trail, went to the White House, and is still in his 20s, and concocted the whole Alliance for Progress, social justice in Latin America, did a bunch of speeches for JFK, but most importantly, he then stayed on with LBJ, and he was there in the glory days. I never met him until years later. God, I wish I'd met him then. We could have been married 60 years. It would have been so great. But all the great civil rights speeches that LBJ gave were Richard Goodwin. And it wasn't just the speeches, it was the policy behind them. It's pretty great. I mean, he wrote the Great Society speech. He coined the phrase Great Society, and that outlaid his entire program of Medicare, aid to education, et cetera. He wrote the Civil Rights Signing Statement, and most importantly, he wrote the We Shall Overcome speech after the Selma demonstrations. And it's an amazing story. I couldn't have done it if my life depended on it. Johnson decided on a Sunday night, when the demonstrations were going on, that on Monday night he was going to give a speech to a joint session of Congress to call for voting rights. So Dick had only from 9 that morning on Monday till 6 that night to write this speech. And Johnson was so smart, he didn't bother him most of the time during the day. I'll tell you when he finally did. But that speech, if you look it up, the We Shall Overcome speech, it's considered one of the best speeches in the 20th century, written in that short period of time. You know, I speak tonight for the destiny of man and the dignity of for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. Every now and then, history and fate meet at a certain time in a certain place. So it was in Lexington and Concord. So it was at Appomattox. So it was in Selma, Alabama. This is not a Negro problem, not a white problem, not a Northern problem, not a Southern problem. It's an American problem. And we are met here to meet that problem. But even if we get voting rights, there's still a long way to go to ensure equality for the Black Americans, and Negro Americans they were called then. But if we work at it, and then he takes the anthem of the civil rights movement, we shall overcome. But then the one time Johnson called him up that afternoon, he just said, I want to talk about Cotulla. And Dick knew what that was. Cotulla was a Mexican-American school that Johnson taught at for a year when he was in college. And he wanted to say something about that. And what was written into the speech was, when I was there in 1928, I saw the pain of prejudice on those kids' place. They were poor. They were discriminated against. They didn't know why. I never thought then, in 1928, that I'd be standing here in 1965 with the power to do something for their sons and daughters. But let me let you in on a secret. I have that power now, and I intend to use it. It was an incredible speech. It was an incredible speech. So, anyway, he was great. He was great. He worked on Bobby Kennedy's Ripples of Hope speech, which is on his gravesite. He worked very much on Al Gore's concession speech. So that whole 60s and the time thereafter, it was dedication to public policy and to being a public servant. And he even more than me, I think, could argue, being older than me, that he lived through the Depression. He lived through World War II. He was in the White House. John F. Kennedy was killed. He was with Bobby Kennedy the night he died. He was at his bedside when he died. And he saw the anti-war movement spiraling out of control. He said, America's been through tough times before. America's not as fragile as you think. That's one of the last things he wrote. And that's what I believe as well.
And that finishes up some highlights from a Q&A with presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin. Took place last night at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City. It was a full house, as you could hear. Her latest book examines how the leadership qualities of Presidents Lincoln, Theodore, and Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson equipped them to lead the country during turbulent times. We want to thank Hancher and the University of Iowa College of Law for asking me and IPR to be part of this Levitt Lecture Series event. This program was edited and produced by our executive producer, Catherine Perkins, also helped today from Camus Leeson. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Drop us a note. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.